Good morning and welcome to the East Tennessee Report, a public affairs program of the Journal Broadcast Group. My name is Frank Murphy. This morning, we are delighted to have as our guest Michael Dowd, Reverend Michael Dowd, author of the new book, Thank God for Evolution, which is a title right there that's going to grab people by the ears, especially on a Sunday morning.
Great. Thanks, morning. Frank. Good to be here.
Now, thank God for evolution. This is what you're going to be talking about, evolution. We're going to be talking about creation. We're going to be talking about religion. We're going to be talking about science. And all of those things come converging together in this book. In fact, the subtitle of the book, How the Marriage of Science and Religion Will Transform Your Life and Our World. I'm overly excited, Michael, to have you here this morning, because I've been one of these people who my whole life I've tried to explain my views on creation and evolution to people. And the only best phrase I came up with to explain to my kids and so on was, well, I believe that God created evolution.
That's good.
So
that works.
That's the way I summed it up myself.
Sure.
But still, that's a challenge for a lot of people. We are only, I think, just barely outside of our listening area. There is a museum of creation in Kentucky that obviously takes a completely different approach. So let's start with the whole creation story.
Sure.
That we've all learned from, you know, when we were tiny.
Sure. Well, actually, Connie, my wife and I, my wife, Connie Barlow, is a science writer, and the two of us have been living on the road for the last 7 years, traveling all over North America, popularizing a sacred, meaningful, or God-honoring way of thinking about evolution.
Yeah.
And we've gone to that Creation Science Museum twice. And the first time we were there, it was just after they opened, the one just south of Cincinnati.
Yeah, that's the one.
And it's, you know, a young Earth creationist museum. Basically, they believe that God created everything in a very literal six-day fashion, just maybe 6,000 to 8,000 years ago. And so we were there just out of curiosity, and they thought we thought they did a great job. And so we were there the whole time. Well, on the side of our van, we've got the Jesus and Darwin fish kissing with hearts between them. and so we pulled it, and the parking lot was packed. And so a security guard gave us kind of this interesting look as we came in. Well, we were there for 2.5 hours, and there was a security guard that watched us the entire time.
Oh, no.
I mean, you don't know about these radical evolutionaries.
Sure.
Right? So then, like 3 months, no, I guess maybe 6 or 7 months later, we were in Louisville, Kentucky, and a religion reporter from the Louisville Courier Journal, which is the big paper in Louisville,
right.
He contacted us first and said he wanted to visit the museum, this creation museum, with us, and called them and see, you know, didn't want to catch them by surprise and get their permission, whatever. And they said, oh, yeah, we remember them back from months ago. Yeah, sure, that's fine. Because, see, on the way out the door, asked us, they said, you know, what did you think? And Connie, my wife, who's a, you know, internationally known science writer, she's not particularly a religious person, and she said, oh, I loved it. She said, you all have done such a great job in terms of telling the meaning aspect, you know, how this touches people's lives. Now, of course, we differ in terms of our perspective. We're evolutionists. But nonetheless, she said, I think you've raised the bar that we who have, you know, these major museums, you know, the Field Museum in Chicago, the American Museum of Natural History.
See, my parents took me there all the time when I practically grew up in the American Museum of Natural History in New York, on Central Park West.
Exactly.
So that's where my worldview comes from,
exactly.
Is from places like that. Okay.
But we don't have any – what Connie and I are envisioning is that there's a room, at least one room, devoted to interpreting the science. How do we interpret this in ways that inspire us to live lives of greater compassion, greater integrity, greater love, greater, you know, generosity? In other words, how can the same science enrich and strengthen our religious faith? And that's really what I'm trying to do in my book, Thank God for Evolution.
Okay. And that's the thing where, you know, I went to Catholic school.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And when I remember being in high school and at a religion class, what I remember from my religion class from all those years ago was when we studied the creation myth, and we were taught in Catholic high school that it was a creation myth for our own faith and our own religion as well as others. And we compared and contrasted the creation myths from different people around the world. And then we'd go down to, you know, biology class and dissect something. We would talk about evolution. So to me, those two have gone hand in hand. Or more like, let me rephrase that. To me, they've gone parallel my whole life, but I never saw them in conflict.
But they weren't probably necessarily integrated.
Correct.
Yeah. I mean, most Catholics, in my experience, I also grew up Roman Catholic and went to a Catholic school for 8 years. And in my experience, most Catholics, probably 70 to 80% of Catholics accept an evolutionary worldview, but they sort of accept it the way you accept death and taxes. It doesn't necessarily inspire them religiously.
Right.
They just kind of accept it. It's sort of, as you said, a parallel track.
But when you get into the whole concept of time, and that's I think what it ultimately comes down to, the difference between creation and evolution in terms of what we think is the timing aspect. You talked about the Creation Museum saying that all of that happened in the last 6,000 years.
Right.
Well, if you take that 1,000 and replace it with, I don't know, billion, then all of a sudden, you know, the timeline isn't necessarily that far off, is it?
Well, you'd have
to rephrase that. The order of things isn't that far off, is what I'm trying to say.
Right, exactly.
Okay.
I mean, one of the biggest difference, though, is the difference between knowing something based on private revelation. That is an insight that comes in a dream or an intuition or,
a lot of our favorite Bible stories.
Exactly. And knowing something based on public revelation. And public revelation is what's being revealed about the nature of reality, what's fundamentally true about the nature of reality, the knowledge of which is not merely coming through the psyche of one individual, mm-hmm. although it's often introduced that way. You know, Einstein has a vision of riding a beam of light. That's a private revelation.
Right.
But then he publishes a paper and the whole scientific community goes to work trying to disprove it.
Yeah.
The skeptical scientific method is all about discerning, is this true in a measurable, empirical way? That is it true in a way that Jews, Christians, Muslims, Buddhists, and atheists can agree it's true?
Mm-hmm.
Or is it merely said to be true because some charismatic or authoritative person said so, or because it's been passed down for so many generations by tradition that we assume it must be true?
Right.
And really, the scientific enterprise is really... it's all about collective intelligence. Our species today is more collectively intelligent than we were 50 years ago or 500 years ago or 5,000 years ago. And so this is public revelation. This is God, reality, revealing truth. And science is discovering that. So the way I think about it and the way I talk about it in my book is that facts are God's native tongue.
There you go.
The primary way that God speaks is through facts.
Right, because he doesn't necessarily have to pick one religion. It might make me one language.
Exactly. And every scientific discovery is simultaneously a discovery, because it's true, it's a discovery, but it's also a revelation. It's also God revealing what's so, what's true.
Now, in the book, you do talk about that collective knowledge, and not that humans aren't the only ones who have stored knowledge. I mean, it goes down to the bacterial level.
Exactly.
Why do we have to get a new flu virus every year? Well, because somehow the flu viruses have learned a way to change to infect us.
Right.
Yeah. And other species as well have to pass on knowledge from the elders or the adults to the babies, right?
Well, what you're pointing to, Frank, is really important. And it's one of the primary drivers of complexity in evolution, which is how is information stored and how is information shared from one entity to another, from one generation to another. And you could say that the evolution of complexity going from the most primitive form of bacteria to the forms of, and then prokaryotic. Okay, so you got prokaryotic bacteria and then the eukaryotic cell, the cell with the nucleus, and then multicellularity, and then mammals. And now in the human realm, you've got at one time the complexity that we had, the largest complexity was a family and a clan.
Yeah.
And all the other families and clans were threats. And
I heard that it takes a village. Is that true?
Well, exactly.
Yes, okay.
And then with language, with words, we began to cooperate at the scale of a village. Or a tribe. And then we began to cooperate at the scale of a chiefdom and a kingdom and so on. And now we cooperate at the scale of a planet. And it's not perfect. We're not cooperating in there's still some kinks to work out in the system. But how information is stored and shared is one of the keys. And the other one, and this is one I really want to make this point, because this is a key to how we move into the future in a healthy, sustainable way. Or to use religious language, how we can co-create thy kingdom come, thy will be done on earth as it is in heaven.
Mm-hmm.
And that is we need to align the self-interest of the parts with the well-being of the whole. In other words, individuals, corporations, and nation states all are self-interested. All entities are self-interested. All bacteria are self-interested.
Yeah.
So how to align the natural self-interest of individuals, corporations, and nations with the well-being of the planet as a whole? And that, doing that, is our key to moving into the future. And that's the key.
All right. We're getting into the capitalism versus socialism debate, aren't
we? Well, it transcends and includes both.
Yeah.
See, that's the exciting thing. It transcends and includes both.
Awesome.
Both capitalism and socialism as concepts, as constructs, emerged before we had an evolutionary worldview.
Mm-hmm.
So we're seeing that to move forward in a healthy way, we've got to find ways of creating, for example, laws, taxes, and moral incentives that align these natural self-interests so that individuals, corporations, and nation states that do well to the larger common good benefit. Mm-hmm. And the more good they do, the more they benefit. So they're incentivized to do as much good as possible. And individuals, corporations, and nations that disregard or harm the common good are taxed or penalized, or there's moral strictures, so that it's in their self-interest to do the right, just, ecological thing. And it's also in their self-interest to not do the unjust, unecological thing.
Right.
And we get that knowledge not from ancient texts, as inspiring as biblical texts, religious texts can be, but we get that knowledge from the scriptures of the universe story. It's what God has been revealing through the entire history of the universe.
Okay, so there's more to it. That smart voice you hear is Reverend Michael Dowd, our guest this morning, the author of Thank God for Evolution, a new book which is available anywhere through the internet and through the website thankgodforevolution.com. We've talked a little bit about the science of it, but I do want to get into that religious aspect of it, that idea that evolution can be the great story, can be the tradition that answers
the creation myth of our age.
That answers all the questions that you have as to basically, why am I here? How did I get here? Which is why these stories were came up with in the first place.
Exactly. I mean, you pointed to before, Frank, that every culture has a story or set of stories that explain the big questions. Where did we come from? Why are we here?
Right. Was it the turtle and the whatever it was? You know,
exactly. Yeah. And there's literally hundreds, probably thousands of creation stories, creation myths. Now, myth not as an untrue story, but myth as what I call night language or mythic or poetic or
mythology.
Exactly.
That
Joseph
thing.
Campbell used the term, like a narrative that puts us in accord with the nature of the universe or the nature of reality. And so the thing about a myth, the thing about a sacred story is that it's not just objectively true, it's subjectively meaningful.
Mm-hmm.
And so we've got hundreds of subjectively meaningful creation stories. Every creation story has been subjectively meaningful to the people that held that as true.
Yeah.
Right? We now have a creation story based on science that's objectively true, but it hasn't been told in its subjective meaningfulness.
Until you came along.
Well, I'm not the only one. There's a number of others that they're basically saying, how can we take the same science and interpret it in a way that deeply inspires people religiously of all different faiths? So people don't have to come to the same belief system around a particular set of beliefs about the past, but we can see that the evidence, an evidential worldview, can help us cooperate across ethnic and religious differences so that we can move into the future in a healthy, sustainable way.
All right, let's break that down right there. You're talking about we look around us, we see the world around us, the scientists look, the Hubble telescope looks, mm-hmm. we see evidence of huge amounts of time.
Great.
Deep time.
Deep time and deep
space,
exactly.
As you talk about in your book. So that's objective. We can see that the God has put the facts there for us to figure out. And now we're going to line that up with this whole idea of, well, has the universe either always been here or did it have a beginning? And that's part of the things that scientists are working on, right?
Exactly. Well, most of the evidence, I mean, the evidence is pretty overwhelming that this universe, I mean, there may be multiple universes, all kinds of cool stuff, but that this universe has been in an expanding state for 13.7 billion years. We rounded off to 14 billion years. And it's also been in a trajectory, greater complexity, greater interdependence, and greater cooperation at larger and wider scale. And we participate in that. So in a very real sense, and I'm speaking scientifically now, humans are the universe after some 14 billion years of unbroken evolution, now becoming conscious of itself. We are literally the universe becoming aware of itself. We didn't come into the world. We grew out of it.
Yeah.
In the same way that apples grow out of an apple tree. So we are that aspect of the universe. We're that part of the universe that has achieved a level of complexity that it can begin to contemplate its own nature. In fact, there's two great quotes from a physicist, Brian Swim, that helps people, get this. He says, 4 billion years ago, the earth was molten rock, and now it sings opera.
Wow.
I mean, this sense of, hang on, let me give you the second quote. So the second quote is, here's the entire universe story, the whole 14 billion years in two sentences. You take a great cloud of hydrogen gas and you just leave it alone and it becomes rose bushes, giraffes, and human beings.
Oh, man.
And that's what science, this is what 97-98% of the scientists of the world would agree with. And this, I say, is religious knowledge also. It's not just scientific knowledge. This is knowledge that can inspire us religiously and help us see that there's a wisdom in our religious traditions that goes deeper than what we could possibly understood before we understood evolution.
And that's what you talked about, where each thing wants to better itself, whether it be the bacteria, whether it be the monkey, whether it be the human, whether it be the corporation, is looking for that. Its own self-interest.
Exactly.
Is looking to survive.
Exactly.
Number one.
Right.
Continue its lineage.
Exactly.
Number two. And whatever choice it makes along the way, or whatever, you know, fortune it happens to get along the way, whether it's hey, guess what? I'm a giraffe. I have a long neck. I can eat the treetops instead of...
And whatever legacy it can leave, whether it's a biological legacy in terms of children, or it's in terms of its impact. You know, there's many people, human beings, that choose not to have children or don't have children for whatever reason, but they can still leave, in fact, they still will leave, whether they want to or not, a legacy.
Well, that's where you get... I know in the book you talk about through language and through the written word, someone who doesn't have children can still pass on information.
They will, yes,
permanently.
Exactly. Yes.
To those behind him or her. Michael Dowd, the author of Thank God for Evolution, is our guest this morning. My head is spinning already. I mean, spinning like the Milky Way galaxy. It just with all the ideas in the book, whereas we talk about the difference between creationists, evolutionists. What is it that upsets the people about the creation myth or the, the evolution concept? You know, we talked about the Scopes monkey trial, which of course happened here in Tennessee.
Exactly.
As a thing, people were upset. They didn't want to think they were related to monkeys. Is that what the...
Well, yeah. One of my favorite quotes from Marlon Navinar. He's a pastor of a very large church in Tulsa, Oklahoma. He's got this great quote. He says, "You know, we've all heard some fundamentalist minded person say, don't tell me I'm related to monkeys. But now that we understand DNA and have cracked its code, we know that we're not just related to monkeys, we're related to zucchini, so let's get over it."
And dolphins too,
exactly.
Right?
Yeah. But here's the
and
thing.
Dogs
I think,
and everything.
Right, exactly.
Yeah.
I think one of the reasons, one of the main reasons why my book has been endorsed by five Nobel Prize winning scientists, as well as theologians and ministers and priests and rabbis across the spectrum, is that it gives voice to the millions in the middle who integrate, who find a way of having science and religion enrich each other, that evolution strengthens my faith, it deepens my
faith.
It's not a matter of reconciling the two. I have a much deeper relationship to God, and it's far easier for me to stay in deepest integrity because I understand my evolved brain, for example, my evolved nature. And I also have a richer appreciation of ancient religious insights. For example, the fall of Adam and Eve is a concept that's common to Jews, Christians, and Muslims. Christians have a concept that's called original sin.
Yeah.
Jews and Muslims don't have that concept because it was invented by St. Augustine in the 4th century.
Okay.
But nonetheless, they both point to the fact that we can now talk about, in terms of evolutionary brain science and evolutionary psychology, that we all have an unchosen nature.
About the reptile brain?
Yeah, exactly. We all have it. And a paleomammalian brain. In other words, we call it our lizard legacy and our furry little mammal. In other words, we have aspects of our brain that evolved to serve our survival and reproduction needs in a very different world than the world that we today live in. So we all have cravings for sugar, salts, and fats.
Especially me.
Well, because for 99% of human history, it wasn't easy to find sugar, salts, and fats. So having a craving for these things allowed our ancestors to survive long enough to reproduce. And yet today, it's very easy to find sugar, salts, and fats. Yet we still have these cravings.
I think I have some in my bag if you want.
I mean, here's another thing that's going to make sense of some of the recent scandals we've seen in the news is that all men and women have a certain base level of testosterone. Now, one of the things that we know scientifically about testosterone is that the higher the testosterone in men and women, the more that person tends to take risks and the more they tend to think about sex.
Okay, I saw this in your book. And I think we're talking about political leaders now.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. Well, and religious leaders too.
Yeah.
I mean, when I wrote my book, Ted Haggard, the president of the National Evangelical Association.
Yeah.
See,
he was in the news again just a week or two ago.
Yeah.
I guess now maybe he's trying to come back and apologize.
Well, yeah. And part of it is he's beginning to understand where the roots of where some of this, you know, began for him. You know, I think he was molested when he was a boy or something like
that. Yeah, that's what he said, yeah.
But my point, though, is that when there's a rise in status, when somebody, for example, they get promoted at work, or they get voted into office, and it doesn't even have to be governor of New York. I mean, it can be your school board, you know, or in any way where, or let's say there's a significant, like you could become the manager of your store or whatever. When there's a significant rise in status where people are looking up to you where they weren't looking up to you before, all men and many women, testosterone levels will rise and rise considerably, especially if it's a significant promotion or you know, whatever. And so all of a sudden, let's say you've got a certain base level of testosterone, okay?
Yeah.
And then you get promoted at work or you get elected into office and all of a sudden you got sex on the brain.
Sure.
Okay? Now you're going to interpret it somehow. This is the key point. You've got to interpret it. By having a neocortex part of our brain, what I call the monkey mind in my book, you will always interpret your experience. So all of a sudden, you're thinking about sex a lot more than you were before. You're a little more risk-taking, and you don't know why. You're going to interpret it somehow. So what if you interpret that maybe something's wrong with your relationship to your spouse or your partner? After all, why would you have
dreaming about
this other person or whatever? Or
why would that intern, White House intern, all of a sudden look good to you?
Exactly.
Right.
Or maybe you're feeling guilty and ashamed, and you interpret that the reason you're having these immoral thoughts is because your great-great-great-great-great-great-grandmother ate an apple because she was tempted by a snake in a garden. You're not going to necessarily know how to stay in impeccable integrity. To use Christian language, you're not going to know how to stay in Christ, that is, in deepest integrity.
Yeah.
And you're probably not going to tell anybody about it, which makes it more likely you're going to fall. So it's not a surprise that we find so many high-status men and women, especially men, in political and religious contexts, falling victim to sexual scandal.
Was it Jimmy Swaggart? Is that the guy I'm
Swagger,
thinking of?
Jimmy Baker.
Right.
There's just lots of them.
Yeah.
And politically and religiously. In fact, just since my book was written, you know, we've seen the governors of New York, we've seen the foot-tapping senator, you know, mayor of Detroit. And part of this is because we are clueless about our evolved brain. So, for example, now some of your listeners may be a little concerned about this, but this is true.
Right.
You can do a Google search on this one. Don't take my word on it. When men are away from their primary partner for even as few as 2 days, their sperm count doubles.
Really?
Yeah.
And that's evolution speaking.
It makes sense evolutionarily, but
that's the caveman
this,
in us.
Exactly. But this is, see, our unchosen nature. We didn't choose to be this way, find ourselves this way.
And your body is designed that way to promote reproduction.
Exactly. To help us survive and reproduce in a very different world than the world that we today have to live in.
Right.
So the question becomes, how do we allow our instinctual energies and our instinctual urges to actually serve our life and to actually increase our integrity and to help us to live lives of real blessing so that we become a blessing to our marriages and our families? And
yes,
our,
Reverend, how do we do that?
Well, part of it is understanding our evolved nature and recognizing that the only way to truly have freedom around our unchosen nature is to be committed to integrity. Because, see, the prefrontal cortex, the frontal part of our brain, the most recent part of the brain to evolve, is all about commitments. And it's only when we are committed in an accountable sort of way that we can override these deeper part of our brains.
So
I was in Hawaii 2 months ago for 5 days. Now, I've got
a
phenomenal relationship with my wife, Connie. We've got a great relationship at every level.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And yet I also know my evolved nature. And so when I'm away from Connie, the temptation to be more flirtatious is very strong.
Right.
So knowing that about myself, there's 4 men in my life that I am very close to and that I either email or call. I did 2 months ago. And I said, hey, listen, I'm going to be away from Connie for the next 4.5 days. And I'm committed to being an impeccable integrity. So I'm going to let you know on Monday when I come back, on a scale of 0 to 10, 0 meaning I was wildly flirtatious, 10 meaning I was impeccably integrous, I'm going to let you know where I was at. And by having that level of support and accountability, it has made it virtually effortless for me to stay in integrity. I don't struggle with my sinful nature in the way that I used to.
This is going to sound crazy, but that's how I lost weight.
Yeah.
I had trouble struggling with that my whole life until they told me, hey, if you do the radio commercials, we need you to do the radio commercials because you're heavy. And I thought, okay, well, I'll do them. But that was that accountability. Because I had to get out there every week and say, here's how much I lost. You know, and then all of a sudden that changed
support,
it. That's what became, I had a support group.
Exactly.
But the accountability is exactly what you're talking about.
Exactly.
So,
And the other key piece for me, at least, is coming to appreciate what I used to judge. In other words, I used to judge myself for these aspects of myself that would sometimes sabotage myself and this and that. And now I recognize that all the things, or virtually all the things that we don't like about ourselves, that we find problematic or struggle with or whatever, those very same things, if it weren't for our ancestors having those traits and those qualities, we wouldn't be alive today. So we can begin to appreciate the fact that we have this evolved nature.
Mm-hmm.
We have the inherited proclivities. We have instincts. And in the same way that you wouldn't expect a wolf or a bear or an elephant to go counter their instincts very easily.
Yeah.
We're expected to go counter to our instincts every day.
Because our instincts are create more babies.
Exactly.
Because
and
they're
sometimes
good,
be selfish
are
and
be,
sometimes be, you
right.
know, and sometimes be airy. I mean, we have all kinds of instincts that really can create challenges for us. And so, I mean, okay, I'm going to say something that's just a teeny bit crass, but it's true. Okay. Is that as a high testosterone alpha male type,
mm-hmm.
my instincts are to mate it if it moves.
Yeah.
And yet if I act on my instincts, I destroy my marriage, I destroy my ministry,
right.
my life goes down the tubes, and I cause tremendous suffering to others if I simply act instinctually. So that's why having this understanding of my evolved brain has given me a much richer appreciation of what traditional religion calls the fall or the original sin. And it also helps me know that what it means to be in Christ, to be in integrity, is not just believing certain miracles in the past. Whether you believe those miracles in the past or not is almost secondary. What really matters is in the present, staying in integrity and having, as you said, the support and accountability mm-hmm. so that it becomes easy to do that.
The slightly crass voice there is Michael Dowd, Reverend Michael Dowd. Thank God for Evolution is the book. ThankGodForEvolution.com is the website. So, we're talking about all this stuff about the evolved brain and how it now has helped us be better people. Has the world evolved, changed? Have we invented stuff too quickly to catch up with our caveman body?
That's a really good question, and I don't know that I've got a great answer to it. I mean, certainly technology is accelerating at such a fast pace. In fact, one of my dearest friends, Tom Attlee, who's one of the world's leading experts in what's called collective intelligence, his website is co-intelligence.org. When people ask him how he thinks we're doing as a species, he says, well, you know, it seems to me that things are getting better and better and worse faster and faster. I think that's true.
Yeah.
And so some things, I mean, technology is so rapid. And is our consciousness, is our thinking, is our heart, is our mind and our values evolving at the same rate? Well, in some ways, yes, some ways, no. Again, I think that's one of the reasons why we need each other. Integrity is not a solo sport. And what I mean by integrity isn't just telling the truth. It's really, in my book, I talk about the four essential components, what I call the DNA, or the four essential bases of integrity, of deep integrity. Mm-hmm. Humility, or faith, or trust. The opposite of which would be arrogance or fear.
Okay, okay. So that's one. Humility, faith, trust.
Okay. Right. The second is authenticity, being authentic, being real, being honest. The third is responsibility, like the opposite of which would be irresponsibility, but it's taking responsibility for the fact that we've all left awake by just doing what's natural, by following our instincts. We've all left awake. So cleaning up some of that stuff, and also recognizing that no one is to blame for your life being the way that it is. It's not, you know, it's refusing to play the blame game.
Okay.
And then the last is serving a larger purpose, serving God's will, serving your higher power, serving in some way, being a blessing to the world beyond your own animal needs, serving something other than your own animal needs. And those four, trust or humility, authenticity, responsibility, and service, are at the heart of every religious tradition.
Yeah.
They're at the heart of the 12-step recovery program. It's not a coincidence that these four, because this, it's when you grow in these four areas, which is what growing in integrity means, you find freedom around your unchosen nature so that you can live a life so that your life is a blessing to the world, and your life is a blessing to your marriage partner or your spouse or your children or whoever else you have to relate to, your boss or your coworkers or whatever.
So the key to it is to justify the golden rule, the do unto others as you would have done unto yourself, with your natural competitive, I'll call it DNA, but it's your inner nature, your instinct, is to defeat the other person when it comes to finding the food, finding the mate, finding, you know, all of those things. And that's right. That's part of it.
That's half of it. I mean, there's two major dynamics in evolution that both are essential. One is definitely competition, no question about it. The other is cooperation. It's mutualism. One of the things we get
into the whole society versus the individual.
In the last 35 years, one of the things that has become so clear is that it's not just survival of the fittest, and the way that that's often been interpreted is survival of the most dominant. No, not at all. It's survival, in many cases, of the most cooperative. It's survival of those who fit best with their environment and the entire world, all of evolution. Imagine you've seen computer programs where one thing morphs into another.
Yeah.
So this morphing concept, the universe has been morphing for 14 billion years.
Right.
And it started out just in simple hydrogen and then more complex atoms. And then molecules, and then more complex molecules, and then creatures.
And you even get into that in the book, how that scientifically happens, how these stars implode, and the hydrogen atoms become helium atoms, which become carbon atoms, which become you know more and more complex, and creating all of the elements of the world that we know.
Exactly, and the important thing to remember is that we're part of this process. That again, you've got simple atoms, more complex atoms, molecules, more complex molecules, creatures, more complex creatures, and then societies and more complex societies. So the entire universe has been in this morphing process. And we're part of that process. And we now can honor the whole of reality, ultimate reality, that creativity which brought it all into existence and is also present in every drop of experience. So we can give God glory, to use traditional religious language, or simply honor the whole to be a blessing to the world, to use more secular language. And have you ever seen like Russian nesting dolls?
Oh, yeah. We have some at home. Grandma brought them to us back when she went to Russia.
Yeah. A fundamental truth that we now understand about the nature of reality that there's just no disagreement about. Whether I do programs among evangelical Christians or Catholic Christians or Buddhist or Hindus or atheists. I mean, I've done programs on all these settings. Nobody debates the nested nature of creativity. Mm-hmm. Subatomic particles within atoms, within molecules, within cells, within organisms, within planets, within galaxies.
Yeah.
At all nested levels, like nesting dolls, every level can create. Every level can bring something new into existence that never existed before. Stars are creative. Mm-hmm. They create the very periodic table of elements. Molecules in community are creative. Hydrogen and oxygen come together and water is created. So this creativity is at all nested levels. And God, from this perspective, is not merely some being outside the universe that one may or may not believe in. God is a sacred proper name for that ultimate creative reality that includes everything else, yet also transcends everything else. So you've got the transcendence and the immanence.
All right, let me ask you a crazy question.
Okay.
I'm enjoying our conversation, and I could go another half hour with you. Would you be available to come back?
I'd be thrilled to.
Here's what we'll do. Next week, we'll do another half hour with Michael Dowd, author of Thank God for Evolution. Same bat time, same bat channel. So,
one thing I do want to mention, though, is that people can download the first 50 pages of my book for free. My promises, I make author's promises to different people. My prologue, introduction, and chapter one, all if they just go to my website, thankgodforevolution.com.
and more next week with Michael Dowd, author of Thank God for Evolution. Thank you very much for being here, and we'll talk to you again. This is the East Tennessee Report, a public affairs program of the Journal Broadcast Group. My name is Frank Murphy. We'll talk to you again next Sunday.